I'd been to Israel before to visit cousins out there and found it beautiful and incredible and exciting to be there, but gradually became aware of what was going on in Palestine, having had friends in the anti-capitalist movement who'd been over doing solidarity work, and decided to go out with a friend who'd been out before. And I went out in January, and I spent the first month in the West Bank, and then I was in Rafah in the Gaza Strip for 3 months. I guess in the context of being Jewish, there's a story I'd like to tell because it stands out, and I think it was such a very unique time in that it was one of the few times when I heard a Palestinian saying something that was anti-Jewish. And it was very exciting being able to challenge him in a very direct way. He was the mayor of a village that had been surrounded by a wall. Settlement roads had been going past, gradually encroaching on his village land until there was basically none left, and they were allowed one well left to irrigate the remaining land. And we'd been with him, there's four of us there, ISM activists, having a look around, talking about what we could do, talking about the olive campaign that had been that happened before when internationals helped the farmers harvest their olives, which otherwise they had great difficulty in doing. And afterwards we were sitting around and just having a friendly chat, and he started talking about the manipulation, the way that the media was manipulated by the Jews, and what was going on in Israel, and coming out with a lot of really kind of stuff that you would expect pretty much everyone in Palestine to think, having gone through what they've gone through. But three out of the four of the internationals there were Jewish. And us being there, it was kind of a bit shocking at first, and we felt a bit, and then we said, do you realize that three of us are Jewish? And obviously he had no idea. And he said, oh, I didn't realize Jews understood. And we had a really amazing discussion. It was, at first I was very, very nervous. I didn't know, was he gonna kick us out? But he was actually very, very interested in why we were there and what we were doing there. And when I actually told him that all my Israeli cousins are really, really pleased that I'm there and actually think it's very, very important that there is a peace process, and that includes a selfish desire for their own safety. And that was a really positive thing. As I said to the soldiers that I met quite often, when I told them that I was Jewish, and they would you know, come out with the stuff about how I was collaborating and whatever, it's like, well, actually I'm here to try and save my cousin's life, because the occupation, as well as killing thousands of Palestinians, is directly responsible for hundreds of Israeli deaths as well. Anyway, so I went to Rafah, which is in the Gaza Strip, and the situation there is possibly the most extreme at the moment, continuously, of anywhere in Palestine. It's a refugee camp of over 140,000 people who piled into a village of 300 people in 67, and then again in 48, and then 67, and continuously as people fled. Two-thirds of the children there are anemic, and that's not because they don't have enough food, it's because they're too terrified to eat or process the food that they're getting properly. Over half of them wet their beds. Hundreds are shot. You meet children walking around that are so traumatized, they can't communicate like normal people anymore. After every Israeli incursion into the town, the children are crazy. They'll just go crazy for a couple of days. It's really difficult. You'll watch them running around stoning each other even. Their clothes are bedraggled. They wear, you even see strange things like ski suits being worn because of the poverty there. One of the big exports from the Gaza Strip used to be flowers, carnations, which were exported to Europe at $1 a flower. Since the crackdown following the Intifada began, the flowers have been kept on the border for weeks sometimes, and flowers don't last that long. So there's huge amounts of poverty. The 60,000 workers that used to go and provide, you know, the bottom level manual labour in Israel, all their work permits have been cut, so the men are wandering around with nothing to do. There's a huge amount of taxis, because that's about the only form of employment available to them, because Israel has put a block on what factories there can be, saying that nothing that can be manufactured in Israel can be manufactured in the Gaza Strip. Going to Rafah was also an incredible experience for someone who became a friend of mine, a girl called Laura, who initially went out to Israel on a birthright program. She was the best friend of the girlfriend of an ISM member in Rafah, And as she was spending more and more time in Israel with the kind of people you'd expect to be on a birthright program and the sort of people you'd expect to support it within Israel, she came to have a very, very pro-Zionist view. And I was having a lot of email debates with this friend of ours who's getting very upset and asking me for help. Finally, they decided that they would spend a week in each other's environments to try and understand the situation. The first night she came down, I took her to stay at the house I was staying in. And our friend Abu Ahmed, whose house I stayed with pretty much continuously over the 3 months I was in Rafah, took her outside to show her where his trees used to be. Of his orchard, there's now 3 lemon trees remaining, one of which is partially destroyed, and we managed to push it back up again after a tank took a slice of it. That was the first thing that shocked her, because she was very religious, and as far as she was concerned, destroying trees in the Holy Land was completely against everything she believed. And that actually opened her mind up enough to start seeing what else was going on. Nobody preached to her, I don't think, but she was very, very interested. And she was in tears because she had this beautiful dream of what Israel was and how she was going to solve all her problems by moving out there. And she's still out in Rafah. She's one of the last members of ISM still out there because people can't get back in again. Her visa's run out. She had a nervous breakdown and she was looked after in Gaza City Hospital. She's back out there, back working again, incredibly passionate and openly Jewish. She couldn't hide it if she tried. She looks like a little settler girl. And it's an amazing bond between the Palestinians and any Jewish activists out there. It was an amazing feeling being able to tell them and being able to talk to them about my cousins. Of my whole family, only 2 have been really critical of me being out there, and they were incredibly nasty and abusive in emails to both me and my mother. But apart from that, they've been incredibly supportive, which was really, really meaningful. Rafa. It's, people always ask me about Rachel and about Tom because they're the internationals that were killed out there. And personally as well, they were the people I was closest to who were killed. An hour after Rachel was killed, a man called Ahmed al-Najjar in an area of Rafah was outside smoking a cigarette. He was 50 years old. He was a street cleaner. He lived with his family. Nobody could say anything about him apart from he was a simple man. And he was outside smoking a cigarette. I saw where he was shot. There were bullets all around where he'd been shot, and he'd several in his body. I was in the hospital cleaning Rachel's body when he was brought into the hospital, already dead. He didn't get any media attention, of course. He was completely swallowed, but we made a vow that every time we talked about Rachel, we would talk about him, because thousands of Palestinians are killed, and they're killed in the same way as Rachel and Tom were killed, which is by a soldier that knows he'll never have to pay anything for it. He'll never be held accountable for what happened. It's a very lazy decision of him to make, whether he pulls the trigger, whether he goes forward in his bulldozer or not, because nobody's going to ask him how many bullets he shot that day and what he did with them. Nobody's going to challenge him in any way. Any investigations that do happen, as we found with both Rachel and Tom, are going to be incredibly biased and come out with a favourable result for him. What happens, as far as I'm concerned, in Palestine, the majority of the atrocities that happen are not direct orders so much as kids with guns being able to do what the hell they liked, having had years and years of propaganda telling them that all the Palestinians are out to get them. And I met soldiers one in particular who actually was crying as I spoke to him and told him what he was doing. And he said, yes, you're right, but what can I do? Please leave me alone, you're right. As he stood outside a house the family had been trapped in for a couple of months, not allowed out, and I just managed to sneak a cake over the wall to them, which was nothing compared to what they were going through. So I was in Rafah for 3 months, and pretty much every night I could hear shooting. Most of the time the shooting was not directly at the house I was sleeping in, but every night there was shooting, and I don't know if anybody who hasn't been in that situation can understand how normalized it gets, how scary it is that it's normalized, but also how your nerves end up. I heard the tank revving its engine outside my window, especially in the last month where a tank took to parking just outside the house we were in. And just the continual level of, it was incredible that the Palestinians didn't hate all Jews. I mean, that's just the thing, it's incredible. It was like, how can you be so understanding? And after the suicide bombings, it was haram, haram, haram to kill civilians. By the majority. Which is just incredible. A few would say, oh, but all Israelis are in the army, there's no such thing as a non-combatant. There's a difference between, for them, the bombings that happen to the civilians and the vast majority of what the armed resistance do, which is against the army. It's against when the army has an incursion. When the army wants to do an Operation Rafah, it comes with 10, 60, 70 tanks, armored bulldozers. That's the only time you ever see or you ever know that soldiers have been on foot. And then you're scared because in order for the soldiers to be on foot, they have to kill everybody that they see. And there'll be 7, 10, 12 people killed that night just because they've been out in the street when the tanks have come in. One night there'd been an attack and there was 7 killed. A tank had been blown up by the armed resistance that night as well. Well, it had been damaged. I think one soldier was killed. And they came back the second night and 5 were killed. We just about managed to start visiting all the Shaheed tents from the first night when another 5 were killed. There was a 14-year-old boy who was trying to make a last-ditch attempt to get home. I guess he thought that he didn't want to spend the night round at his friend's house. He just wanted to get home. He decided to take the risk. I took a similar risk, actually. One time there was an incursion, and I knew a friend of mine had been locked in the apartment we used, and he didn't have a key to get out. And there was an incursion at one end of town, and it was a very strange sight, because whenever there's an incursion, the PA basically flee their buildings because the Israelis know where their buildings are, and they know that the PA and the police and the security infrastructure, which is now supposed to be clearing out the armed resistance, is also being attacked by the Israelis. Very strange. And so they were all fleeing town, telling me that the soldiers were that way, and I was having to run in the opposite direction from these men with guns, thinking, this is a really stupid thing to do. This is how Palestinians get killed. This is how Palestinians get killed. But I managed to make it, and most of the time you do make it. It's such a lottery whether you get killed or not. It's so arbitrary, it's so careless, it's so... whether you get caught or not, whether that bullet kills you or not, as has happened with Tom, who's in a coma for the rest of his life, Brian Avery, whose face has been destroyed, but if it had been an inch backwards, he'd have been dead. And it doesn't make any difference to the soldiers. I don't know, I can talk more about what I saw. I can talk about the wells, actually. I'd like to talk about the wells, because that was a project that meant a lot to Rachel, and so... The two water wells that provide over 50% of the water to Rafah were built in a lot of collaboration with the Israelis because it was during the Oslo peace process. And the Israelis are taking a lot of the settlers are taking a lot of the water out of the Gaza Strip and using it to irrigate the Negev Desert. And so when they were building the wells, there was IDF personnel there the whole time measuring to make sure they didn't drill too deep. So there was absolutely no... they knew exactly where the wells were. The three main settlements in the Gaza Strip have positioned themselves over the water aquifers, over the underground reservoirs, the natural reservoirs underneath the Gaza Strip, coincidentally. And so all the wells have to be quite close to the settlement. One night, 30th of January, there was a massive incursion and two of these major water wells were destroyed. When the workers went to try and rebuild the wells with... they have signs saying they're municipality workers. The PA phone the IDF. There's a very strange top-level communication going on. And the workers were shot at. And nobody got killed, but the warning shots were going. So they asked us to go along and be human shields there. And we were human shields for the workers there, which was frightening. And a lot of the time it was very boring just standing around while they were building. But it was... that something that basic, you can't fix your own water well without having an international standing in front of you with a megaphone trying to explain to the soldiers and hoping that the soldiers understand and hoping above all that the soldiers understand and care that these are municipality workers and non-combatants. I don't know if we'd have the I don't know whether that'd be a good idea anymore, because now it seems that internationals are no more safe from being killed than Palestinians, and that's the situation.